How Baltimore is helping small businesses recover after protests hit them hard. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, November 25th, and thank you for joining us today. Let's start today with agriculture, since many of us will soon be enjoying a cornucopia of meat and produce. Well, not to be a buzzkill, but it turns out it's been a rough year for the nation's farmers. The U.S. Department of Agriculture now says that farm profits in 2015 will drop nearly 40% from last year. So what's going on? We asked Marketplace's Scott Tong to look into that.
Farmers are on course for the biggest drop in profits in 32 years. Prices for everything they sell are tumbling, says Jeff Hopkins, an economist at the U.S. Agriculture Department.
The decline in prices is broadly across the entire set of commodities.
Demand is down for milk, hogs, cattle, wheat, soybeans. Now, the big grain is, of course, corn. And there, it's not just feeding fewer animals and fewer people. It's feeding fewer cars. Lots of corn becomes ethanol, which competes with gasoline.
So as you see the price of oil decrease, the price of corn is just reflecting competition with oil.
David Widmar at the consultancy Agricultural Economic Insights says there's also a global commodity story here, a super cycle. From around 2002 to 2014, the prices of food, minerals, oil, they all rose. So to join the party, farmers made more.
And so they're willing to pay more for farmland and for cash rents and fertilizers.
Supply raced to catch up with demand, and then outraced demand. Prices fell.
But now we're on the adjustment side of that. And so this is where things get painful.
How to get through this? Some farmers have arranged higher selling prices or hedges. Some will borrow. And many will work second jobs. As for consumers, well, we may not enjoy the low prices. For every dollar I spend on food at the store, just 20 cents goes to farmers. Here's economist Chad Hart at Iowa State.
You look at a box of cornflakes and you think, well, corn, that's got to be the major thing in there. That's the major cost. You probably actually pay more for the cardboard box around the cornflakes than you do for the corn in the box.
Just keep in mind the corn grower in the box is starting to struggle. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Next Monday in Baltimore, the first trial begins of a police officer in the death of Freddie Gray. Gray died in police custody last spring, and six police officers face charges ranging from misconduct to second-degree murder. It's been almost 7 months since protests erupted in Baltimore over Gray's death. Around 400, mostly small businesses, sustained damage or were looted during those protests. The city's Economic Development Agency released a report this week looking at how those businesses have recovered since. Marketplace's Noel King reports.
Taylor Alexander owns Flawless Damsels, a women's clothing store in Baltimore. She has a favorite month. She calls it Money-Making May because business is so good. But this year was different because of the protests in April.
My business was completely vandalized and looted. I was left with only the paint on the walls. I had no windows, no doors. I had to replace my floors because of all of the glass that they broke.
She closed for 4 months and sustained more than $60,000 in damage. Alexander estimates she lost another $100,000 in revenue.
I took a very, very, very big economic hit.
What allowed her to reopen was a grant from the Baltimore Development Corporation, the city's economic development agency. Bill Cole is president of the BDC, which worked with businesses, distributing nearly $900,000 in grants and loans.
And the services ranged from, you know, working with their insurance company to the more extreme of providing them with zero interest loans and or facade improvement grants to help, you know, restore a broken door or a window.
The result?
None have closed for good. 93% of those businesses, slightly over 400, have reopened.
But he admits there hasn't been much new investment in Baltimore neighborhoods that need it. Those were some of the neighborhoods hit hard by the protests. Kirby Fowler is president of the Downtown Partnership of Baltimore, a nonprofit that works to grow downtown. He says what worked in that area was investment in anchor institutions.
Anchor institutions are something like hospitals or universities. Far out in West Baltimore, you have small businesses that dot different corners and blocks, but it is a great distance to many of those great anchor institutions.
Even without those institutions, one city initiative that has grown since the unrest, training people for jobs outside of troubled neighborhoods and planning to invest in transportation to get them to work. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a holiday holding pattern. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If any country can hold its head up high at this week's climate change conference in Paris, it could be Britain. Granted, the UK arguably started greenhouse gas pollution. It was, after all, the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution. But it has been trying to make amends. Britain passed the world's first carbon act, imposing legally binding cuts in emissions, and it's invested heavily in solar and wind power. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports on how green the UK really is.
Goes at 1.20 on Ms. Gray today on Macaulay. £1.20 bence. Down past 1.20. 1.20.
An auction is underway in this large building in eastern England. Local farmers are selling their produce.
£1.20. Cheap collie.
Meanwhile, on the roof above them, a small team of workers have been busy cutting the auction house's energy bill and combating climate change.
OK, so up here on the roof, we've got around 400 solar panels attached to the metal roof. Providing power to the auction house below.
Jonathan Selwyn launched his solar installation firm Lark Energy 5 years ago. Now it's one of the country's biggest in a market that's expanded fast.
As an industry, we're very proud of what we've achieved to date. We've installed 9 gigawatts of solar power in the last 4.5 years, which is roughly a couple of nuclear power stations worth.
It's not just solar power that's taken off here. Wind power has grown even faster. That alone is now generating around 10% of the UK's electricity. All this has apparently turned Britain into a world champion carbon cutter.
We showed in our Low Carbon Economy Index report this year that Britain has had exceptional performance.
Jonathan Grant of PwC, the consulting firm, he says last year the UK reduced its greenhouse gas emissions relative to the size of its economy by more than any other country.
The exceptional performance in 2014 is also reflected in Britain's stronger performance over the last 15 years relative to its G20 peers.
It gets even better. The winding gear in this coal mine is headed for the scrap heap. The last deep pit in Britain closes next month. And the government says all the country's coal-fired power stations will be shut within a decade. Coal mining, a dirty and dangerous industry, is coming to an end here. So the UK is phasing out the most climate-threatening fuel. Environmentalists the length and breadth of Britain must be rejoicing. But are they? Someone who should know is Morgan Curtis, a bicycling climate campaigner.
So I've been on the road for almost 5 months now on my bicycle. And we started in the US in mid-June. And then we've been in Canada, Iceland, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Germany, the Netherlands, the UK and Ireland.
Morgan and her partner are biking to the climate conference in Paris. I joined them on a short leg of their journey on the outskirts of London to find out what British environmentalists have been telling them on the way.
In the UK, we've definitely had some dissatisfaction with current energy policy.
Dissatisfaction, and this is a country that's got a very good record for cutting emissions.
So there's a big mismatch between kind of international rhetoric and reputation and what's happening on the ground here in the UK.
British environmentalists say the UK is not as squeaky clean as it seems. One of the reasons its emissions have fallen, they say, is because it's offshored a lot of its manufacturing. So the carbon emitted in producing the goods Britain imports winds up on someone else's tally. And while the renewables have been a success story, they claim that new industry is now in peril because the government has just announced plans to phase out subsidies for renewable energy. Dozens of small solar firms are closing down.
What I've been hearing from our travels all around the UK has been that the British government is just not taking climate change seriously. We've got a commitment to an international climate treaty, but we've got support for fracking and we've got the collapse of renewable support. Domestic policy has to match what we're trying to do at the international level.
Oh, hang on a sec. That was a bump in the road. Bad omen, perhaps, as we head towards the climate change conference. The record of the world champion carbon cutter is less impressive than it seems. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We'll have more stories about climate change as the Paris talks continue, the behavioral economics of it, and why it's so hard for countries to believe what other countries promise to do about it. You can see all of our coverage at marketplace.org. As for environmentally conscious bikers, probably not as many of those on the road this week, more like in airplanes and in cars. The AAA says nearly 47 million of us are going to be at least 50 miles from home this holiday weekend. That's the most travelers on the road since 2007. It's probably because the economy's finally doing better, people are feeling better about it. Oh, and oh yeah, gas and airplane fuel are really, really cheap. On a lighter note, if you watch a decent amount of television or streaming video, you may have been thinking, what's the deal with all these comedy specials? Get it? What's the deal? Jerry Seinfeld. Anyway, I do not have a comedy special, clearly, but a lot of other people do. HBO, Comedy Central, and Showtime have been cashing in on funny for a while. And Netflix is also rolling out the specials. NBC is launching a comedy streaming service, and video services like Vimeo are getting into the mix, too. Marketplace's Adrian Hill looks at the economics behind the stand-up special.
Cheers, you guys. Thanks for coming out.
HBO touted Amy Schumer's special as the comedy event of the year. Over on Netflix, Chris Tucker has a new special this year. So does Aziz Ansari.
This is Madison Square Garden. Oh, my God.
And it's not just big names getting the attention. As streaming services and cable channels go after more comedy, less famous comedians are getting a shot. Comedians like Brent Morin.
You can't read? That's a VIP. You don't look very important at all.
Okay, it's a personal attack. I'm Brent Morin. It's
who?
This is my special, my first comedy special for Netflix, and I'm about to go on stage in 5 minutes. I have to get in there.
Oh, you have to.
That's from the trailer for Morin's special coming out on Netflix next week.
I've built a name in L.A., not necessarily anywhere else. It's kind of why I named the special I'm Brent Morin. I kind of want to push my name out there.
For up-and-comers like Morin?
It's not a money-making thing.
It's the 69 million Netflix subscribers thing.
Right now, to me, this is an investment for my future.
And for the entertainment companies making these shows.
It's a very cost-efficient way to get eyeballs and entertain them in a really good way.
That's Brian Volkweis, who heads up Comedy Dynamics. He produces stand-up specials. He says the cost all depends on the talent. There are specials that cost $50,000 to make and a rare few that cost $8 million.
The market is, and I've been in the comedy business over 17 years, and it's the best I've ever seen.
Volkweis says social media and YouTube have helped tremendously, as has our appetite for funny.
Because that's what people are into. I think if the public was into watching, lizards climb rocks, then that's what the networks would make.
Simple enough, supply and demand. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it turns out that rude or snotty sales clerks who work at luxury stores actually cause customers with low self-confidence to spend more.
That and other unexpected tricks retailers use to make you spend your money. But first, let's do the numbers. This is how they do it. On the day before a holiday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was flat, adding just 1 point to close at 17,813. The S&P 500 was also flat, ending where it began at 2088. The NASDAQ gained 0.2% or 13 points to finish at 5,116. An economic data dump, most of it positive, got a mixed response from financial firms. Bank of America and Citigroup each dipped about 0.2%. Wells Fargo gave back 0.1%, but Goldman Sachs was up 0.2%. Trust and JP Morgan Chase deposited 0.1%. Airline stocks ran into some headwinds as one of the busiest travel days of the year got underway. United, Continental, and JetBlue each drifted down 1%. Southwest and Delta were both off 0.75%. Only American Airlines overcame concerns that travelers worried about terrorist attacks might start staying home. Its shares climbed 0.2%. Bonds were steady. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note held at 2.23%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
You're listening to Marketplace from APM. I'm Molly Wood. The Western United States is in a drought. We all know that. But it's also been hot and windy in Southern California over the last few weeks. And wildfires love these conditions. Santa Ana winds in excess of 50 miles an hour can spread fires quicker than ever, which means more property is at risk for damage or destruction. Insurance companies are well aware, and so they are expanding homeowners' insurance packages to include firefighters. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains.
If you live in Malibu or Bel Air, you might already know what I'm about to tell you. If you don't, here's the deal. Homeowners insurance for really rich people is different. AIG is one provider that offers insurance for, quote, high net worth individuals and their families. One of the perks is what's called the Wildfire Protection Unit, firefighters with an engine and hand crews. Now, AIG is quick to say it's not a private fire department, but in some ways it kind of is. That could cause a problem.
They're not in the know.
Patrick Titus is an operations sections chief on an incident management team. Essentially, he's one of the guys in charge of telling all the different crews what to do when fighting a wildfire.
They are just there as a hired service by the insurance company to take care of that piece of property. So that's where you get into the life safety issue with the public and everybody else is them not being involved directly.
Titus says that could lead to confusion, especially for the public. If you see a guy in a helmet and boots driving an engine to one particular house to put flame retardant on it, it sends a peculiar message. But he also says insurance companies being willing to help isn't a bad thing.
You know, there's never enough resources when there's a lot of fires going on. So in that regard, it's a benefit because they're in there taking care of their clients and taking care of their structures, and it's one less thing we have to worry about.
But insurance companies aren't doing this out of the kindness of their hearts. It makes business sense. Jim Salick is vice president of underwriting programs at USAA. Most of the homes they insure are your everyday suburban houses, not on a cliff in the Santa Monica Mountains.
You know, let's face it, it's less expensive to prevent.
USAA's built it into the cost of homeowners insurance policies in the West. But Salick says this service isn't an effort to boost overall wildfire suppression. Their contract crews are only out to protect homes with their policies, which could put those crews in a tough situation if a fire makes a turn.
So, you know, what would happen in a specific situation, I don't know for sure, but their main focus is on responding to our members' policies.
USAA contracts with a firm called Wildfire Defense Systems, or WDS. All of their employees are private contractors. David Torgerson is that company's president. He says they're not really set up to be the first responders to a wildfire.
Although all these resources are trained and hired by the government to do initial attack and fight fire on the fire line, these insurer programs are more working to be more in the backgrounds. They're working before the fire and after the fire, doing supplemental roles to prepare the structures to be more survivable, and then check on them very quickly after the fire passes.
After all, the insurance teams aren't there to protect lives. They're there to protect property. Kyle Dickman worked for the Forest Service for a few years and now writes about fires. He says firefighting is becoming more and more privatized, and he thinks that actually makes sense, especially as people continue to build houses in dangerous spots.
If you make all of those choices and then expect the Forest Service or BLM or your city or county firefighter to risk their lives to save your home from a wildfire that is going to happen every year, every 10 years, or every 15 years, I think that that's not a realistic expectation.
Most firefighters don't think insurance companies getting into the game is necessarily a bad thing. It's just got to be controlled. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
When you're off doing your holiday shopping this year, assuming you still shop in actual stores, you should know there's a little science behind every sale. Stores have whole little bags of tricks to get you to buy things you don't need or even want. And I am not just talking about those 40% off signs. Eleanor Smith wrote a piece about this for The Atlantic called "Why You Bought That Ugly Sweater." And she's here now to tell us more. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi.
Okay, Eleanor, so why did I buy that ugly sweater?
Well, for this article, I looked into the research that has been conducted on shopping, and I found that there is a multitude of studies that have looked into how to subtly manipulate shoppers into purchasing merchandise. And then as a result, everything from a store's layout to wall color to a clerk's behavior in a store is often carefully calculated.
And there are some things we know, like that stores price things high with the intention of putting them on sale later. But explain to me how,
right. You
know, some of the more counterintuitive things work, like snootiness, for example.
Right. Yeah, that was one very interesting study. It turns out that rude or snotty sales clerks who work at luxury stores actually cause customers with low self-confidence to spend more and in the short term to actually feel more positively toward that brand.
Oh, that's so sad. So basically they get bullied into buying like a Louis Vuitton purse. And then they feel like Louis Vuitton made them better?
Well, I don't know if they get bullied. What the study said is that when someone is rejected by a person who represents a brand that they want to be affiliated with, then purchasing an item from that store or brand makes them feel accepted and actually affirms their self-concept.
I see. So it's a much more subtle sort of peer pressure.
Right.
Tell us some more of these tricks, like the atmospherics, the lighting and music. Tell me about some of that.
Yeah, so atmospherics are the physical characteristics of a retail space that are carefully designed to influence a customer's mood and manipulate the odds that they will make a purchase. So some of those atmospherics are the color of the walls, actually like cool blue-toned interiors are actually much preferred by customers, whereas warmer orange-toned interiors make customers feel less enthusiastic about the merchandise and actually balk at high prices. Mm.
And then talk a little about scents. You said that can also have an impact?
Sure, yeah. It turns out it's well known that stores that are jammed with merchandise make people feel claustrophobic, while those that are too bare can cause people to feel agoraphobic. And this one study found that stores could counteract a customer's anxiety with the appropriate scent. So a cluttered store might light a seashore-scented candle to evoke spaciousness, or a big box store could make their customers feel cozy by piping in, say, the scent of firewood.
And, I mean, can you quantify how well it works?
Right. Yeah, no, I don't know how many stores actually apply all of these tricks, but the amount of research implies that stores are paying attention.
Eleanor Smith wrote an article for The Atlantic on why you bought that ugly sweater. Eleanor, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. This final note before we go. Earlier this week, we talked to a mall manager in Butte, Montana. Now, she hit it well, but I could tell she was a little bummed she had to work on Thanksgiving. Well, in some malls across America, it's the managers who are making the stores stay open on the holiday. The Wall Street Journal reports today that many malls are actually forcing small stores and restaurants to open for Thanksgiving shopping by threatening fines in letters that say staying open on Thanksgiving is mandatory. The reason is that a lot of big anchor stores like Macy's or JCPenney are opening on Thanksgiving, and mall owners want shoppers to have a consistent experience. Of course, not every big-name store is opening on Turkey Day. Nordstrom, Barnes & Noble, GameStop, Costco, and REI are among those staying closed. And the Financial Times notes that many consumers are actually cheering the companies who are refusing to open. In fact, nearly 50,000 people have signed a petition asking JCPenney to stay closed on Thanksgiving so its employees can enjoy the holiday. The National Retailers Federation says the Thanksgiving weekend accounts for about $50 billion in revenue each year, but the numbers have been falling over the last 2 years. And we know that you are looking for something to do over that long holiday weekend, or maybe something to listen to while you cook tomorrow. And we can help. If you've missed a show or you want to check out our new podcast, Codebreaker, now is the time. Go to your favorite podcast app or to marketplace.org and subscribe. And happy Thanksgiving, everyone. That'll do it for today. The Dow was basically flat. It added just 1 point. The S&P 500 was also flat. The NASDAQ gained 0.2% or 13 points. Chris Clark, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer this program for us. I'm Molly Wood. Marketplace will be open on Thanksgiving. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.